Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the November 27th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows traditional Thanksgiving scene, dinner table. Looks like Dad's carving the turkey, wife and a few kids, maybe Grandma sitting at the table with them. Dog is sitting by looking for leftovers. But they're on a beach, and just beside them and hovering over them is a huge tidal wave. The title is Worst Case Scenario. A massive winter wave of COVID spreads across the U.S. just in time for Thanksgiving. And we'll start with that main story. COVID surge overwhelms hospitals across America. What happened? COVID-19 case counts and hospitalizations exploded across the country this week as governors imposed new restrictions and the White House Coronavirus Task Force warned of aggressive, unrelenting, expanding broad community spread. In Chicago, officials issued a stay-at-home advisory, and Philadelphia banned most private indoor gatherings. In Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer set off a firestorm by canceling all in-person learning at high schools and colleges for 3 weeks, as well as shuttering casinos and movie theaters. Yet a new Reuters poll found that almost 40% of Americans intend to gather with 10 or more people for Thanksgiving, despite a national average of 156,000 new infections a day over the past week. The death toll hit more than 1,700 on a single day, and hospitalizations reached new highs at more than 73,000. We are in a full-blown pandemic crisis, said Robert Kanagi, CEO of Stormont Vale Health Hospital System in Topeka, Kansas, where hallways and waiting rooms were being converted into ad hoc COVID-19 treatment areas. In South Dakota, the seven-day test positivity rate rose to 58%, while in New Mexico, according to federal officials, the rate of community spread was threatening the health system. At the Moore County Hospital District in North Texas, staff sought help from as far as 500 miles away in Kansas City because all other local hospitals were filled beyond capacity. Over a six-day stretch, six COVID-19 patients perished there while awaiting transport. These are our neighbors, our family members, said Jeff Turner, the hospital's chief. That makes it tough. What the columnist said. At the root of this third wave is public fatigue, said Jamie Downey in the Washington Post. After 9 months of living in strict social bubbles and seeing friends and family only behind masks, Americans are gravitating back to old habits and holding dinner parties, game nights, and sleepovers. In fact, contact tracers now report that these small private social gatherings, rather than the earlier nursing home outbreaks and super spreader events, are fueling the pandemic's latest surge. Yes, the numbers are grim, said Jacob Sullum in Reason.com, but officials shouldn't respond by placing arbitrary legal restrictions upon their citizens. In some places, schools are closing even though children, especially elementary school kids, have not been a major source of virus transmission. In others, like Chicago, officials are urging people to stay at home while keeping restaurants, movie theaters, and fitness clubs open. When there's little rhyme or reason to COVID-19 control measures, people are unlikely to obey them. Please cancel Thanksgiving, said James Hamblin in TheAtlantic.com. The prospect of tens of millions of Americans congregating in multi-generational units indoors while having lively, particle-spewing arguments over three-hour meals threatens to make our current worst-case scenario even worse. For the well-being of those you love and the country, eat at home just this one Thanksgiving and call or Zoom your friends and family. Next year, after we've been vaccinated, we will have twice as much to celebrate. It will be like a super Thanksgiving. And a related main story, as new vaccine breakthroughs offer hope. What happened? Two U.S. drug firms announced this week that their experimental COVID-19 vaccines appear to be roughly 95% effective in preventing sickness, fueling optimism that millions of Americans could receive shots by the end of this year. Pfizer and its German partner, BioNTech, delivered the first complete set of results from a late-stage vaccine trial, reporting that of the study's nearly 44,000 participants, 170 became infected with COVID-19. Only 8 of those cases were in volunteers who received the vaccine. The rest were in participants that got a placebo. Pfizer said it will apply to the FDA for emergency authorization within days. Biotech firm Moderna, meanwhile, said 95 people in its ongoing 30,000-person trial developed COVID-19 with symptoms. Only 5 of those had received Moderna's vaccine. That indicates an efficacy rate of 94.5%, far above the 50% needed for FDA approval. Both companies' vaccines use a technology that has never been approved before. In traditional vaccines, a patient is injected with dead viral material, which triggers the body to produce specialized antibodies. The experimental vaccines use a synthetic version of coronavirus genetic material that leads human cells to produce copies of the virus' outer spike proteins. Those proteins spark the immune system to mount a defense. If Pfizer's vaccine is approved, federal officials hope to immunize 20 million high-risk Americans in December. The light at the end of the tunnel is getting a little brighter, said infectious disease expert Dr. William Schaffner. What the columnist said, these vaccines could change the game, said David Axe in thedailybeast.com. It's encouraging that Pfizer's shot seems to work well on older people who sometimes don't respond to vaccines. And the side effects, so far, appear to be minimal. At worst, a headache or temporary fatigue. Still, distribution will take a huge coordinated effort. Pfizer and Moderna's vaccines require 2 doses, about 3 weeks apart. And Pfizer's has to be kept at minus 94 degrees Fahrenheit, so clinics will have to buy industrial freezers. Vaccine rollout is one of the most monumental tasks facing President-elect Joe Biden, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. The federal government is buying 100 million doses of Moderna's vaccine and the same amount of Pfizer's, but no distribution plan has been released, and Biden's team is being kept in the dark by the Trump administration. Dr. Moncef Slaoui, head of President Trump's Operation Warp Speed project, said he wants to brief the incoming administration, calling the vaccine's timely distribution a matter of life and death for thousands of people. This medical triumph is stunning, said Daniel Tenriero in NationalReview.com. It typically takes 8 years to develop a vaccine, but in only 8 months and using entirely new technology, Pfizer and Moderna have created vaccines that appear to be far more effective than the annual flu shot and about as good as the measles vaccine. Thanks to this historic breakthrough, there's a chance we'll be able to suppress COVID-19 by mid-2021. Controversy of the week is titled, President Biden, What Can He Accomplish? Now comes the unimaginably hard part, said Jonathan Allen in NBCNews.com. When President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. is sworn in on January 20th, 2021, he will inherit a raging pandemic, a badly damaged economy with high unemployment, and an angry and polarized nation. Worse, unless Democrats can pull off two upset wins in Georgia's Senate runoffs, Biden will tackle these crises as the first president since George H.W. Bush to take office without his party controlling Congress. Remember the political dysfunction and economically painful austerity of Obama's last 6 years in office, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. Now imagine a repeat of all that, but with more death. If he remains the majority leader, Senator Mitch McConnell will try to thwart the entirety of the Democratic president's agenda, starting with tax increases on the wealthy and corporations. With the norms of government shattered in the Trump era, McConnell may decide to block Biden's judicial nominees and some of his cabinet appointments if he deems them too liberal. Even a miracle in Georgia won't save the more progressive planks of Biden's agenda, which would need the votes of red and purple state Democrats in a 50-50 Senate. Without such a miracle, it's safe to say that his entire presidency will be crippled before it begins. Biden must also contend with the new 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, said Fred Kaplan, also in Slate.com. The court is likely to be hostile to legislation addressing gun violence, climate change, voting rights, and other critical issues on the progressive agenda. Nonetheless, Biden can still get an awful lot done. With a stroke of his pen, Biden can undo many of Trump's 176 executive orders, scrapping the Muslim travel ban, reinstating DACA, ending wall construction, restoring protections to federal lands Trump opened to mining and drilling, and he may find McConnell more willing to make deals than he was during the Obama presidency. McConnell won't work with Biden because it's moral or right or patriotic, said Brett Budowski in TheHill.com. But with voters desperate for help and 20 GOP senators up for re-election in 2022, McConnell may decide it's in his cold-blooded political interest not to fight those midterms as the do-nothing Republican Senate. Biden can be most effective where it matters most, said David Lenhart in the New York Times. Climate change. He can, on day one, rejoin the Paris Climate Accord, an important statement of U.S. commitment. And his team is already exploring ways to reduce carbon emissions through regulation rather than legislation. It has not escaped voters' notice that vast sections of the fire-charred West are hotter and drier than ever, and that an endless parade of hurricanes and storms pounded the Gulf Coast this year. If only one or two Republican senators acknowledges these terrifying realities, Biden would have a majority for meaningful action. It'll actually be a blessing for Biden if he has a divided government, said Bobby Jindal in the Wall Street Journal. Why? Because a McConnell-led GOP Senate would give him someone to blame for not pursuing court packing, Medicare for all, large tax increases, or any other far-left scheme that would surely earn Biden a brutal midterm backlash. McConnell may thwart Biden's more ambitious plan, said John Podhoretz in CommentaryMagazine.com, but he can't keep Biden from fulfilling the core promise he made to voters, that he would not be Donald Trump. If President Biden wants to be remembered as a resounding success, all he has to do is sit in the Oval Office not being crazy. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for second chances. After a hiker whose heart stopped for 45 minutes after being rescued from a blizzard on Washington's Mount Rainier was brought back to life by doctors. "I'm still just shocked and amazed," said Michael Napinski, age 45. It was a good week for Trump campaign staff with the merciful shuttering of the campaign's ill-fated voter fraud hotline. The hotline was inundated by prank calls, including many consisting of loud farting noises. "It's misery," said one staffer of working in the room from hell. And it was a good week for sibling rivalry after an 18-year-old Taiwanese man emerged from a coma after 62 days when his older brother threatened that if he didn't wake up, "I'm going to eat your favorite chicken filet." But it was a bad week for massive fraud after officials overseeing New Zealand's Bird of the Year vote discovered that 1,500 votes had been cast for Little Spotted Kiwi from a single IP address. Once the suspicious votes were discounted, the fat, flightless Kakapo emerged victorious. It was a bad week for Ernest McKnight of Florida, who told officers arresting him after an alleged spree of car theft and burglary that he had brought his 8-year-old son along to toughen him up. Local Sheriff Grady Judd responded that taking a child out with you while you commit felonies is not the proper way to create a positive influence. And it was a bad week for Tucker Carlson after the Fox News host cited as proof of election fraud that James Blaylock of Georgia had voted even though he's dead. Agnes Blaylock, 96, came forth to say she voted under her married name, Mrs. James Blaylock. Carson apologized, but insisted that a whole bunch of dead people did vote. We're on the briefing page, titled this week, Biden's Challenges Abroad. President Trump pulled the U.S. back from global leadership. Can Joe Biden restore it? What is Biden facing? Trump's America First foreign policy was a radical departure from the multilateral approach of the Obama administration, and it has transformed the international landscape. The U.S. pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact, the World Health Organization, and the U.N. Human Rights Commission, and it unilaterally withdrew from the multi-party Iran nuclear deal and the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. After 4 years of being berated by Trump, European allies no longer feel they can depend on the U.S. or its commitment to NATO, although they have, at Trump's insistence, begun to spend more on defense. The U.S.-China relationship is at its most tense in decades. Both North Korea and Iran are further along in their nuclear programs than they were when Trump took office, with a jubilant Kim Jong-un recently showing off a new ICBM that can reach every city in the U.S. What will he take on first? Biden, who has decades of foreign policy experience as vice president and as chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, wants to reassert American leadership on the biggest crises facing the globe. Most pressing is the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. will rejoin the World Health Organization and seek to coordinate an international plan to distribute vaccines. Climate change is the other major challenge. Once back in the Paris Climate Accord, Biden wants to lead global efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions with a $2 trillion clean energy and infrastructure plan. In his very first week in office, Biden plans to save the last remaining nuclear arms control treaty, New START, which expires in February. While Trump wanted to alter the pact, Russian President Vladimir Putin is willing to extend it without changes for 5 years. Biden will likely agree. But Biden will resume robust support for Ukraine, which is still battling Russia, and it's possible he'll further sanction Moscow for its attempts to interfere in U.S. elections. What about U.S. allies? Repairing damaged U.S. alliances is central to Biden's plans, but many allies are wary. Some Europeans, such as French President Emmanuel Macron, say that America's retreat from international leadership began not with Trump, but under the Obama administration, when the U.S. failed to act against Syria's use of chemical weapons. But if Biden is wholeheartedly committed to the defense of traditional allies, they are keenly aware the American people could well vote for another isolationist in 4 years. Europeans can no longer take for granted that they can trust the U.S., even on basic things, said former Norwegian Premier Gro Harlem Brundtland. Europe itself has changed. Brexit means that the U.K., our closest ally, no longer has a voice in the EU. And London is desperate for a favorable trade deal with the U.S. that it may not get. What about the Middle East? Like Trump, Biden sees Asia, not the Middle East, as America's foremost strategic challenge. So Biden is unlikely to recommit troops to Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Still, there will be many changes. The Trump administration has sold Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates billions of dollars worth of weapons, but the Biden administration is likely to cut off supplies for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, which has killed thousands of civilians, and punish the Saudis for human rights abuses, such as the murder of journalist and U.S. resident Jamal Khashoggi. The Israel-Israeli relationship will also change. Biden has always been a staunch supporter of Israel, but he doesn't seem Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's hardline policies as beneficial for Israeli or U.S. interests. He will keep the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem, but will oppose continued Israeli settlement building in Palestinian territories and restore U.S. aid to the Palestinians. What about nuclear proliferation? Biden wants to rejoin the 2015 Iran nuclear pact, but Tehran has increased its stock of low-enriched uranium over the past 4 years and would have to agree to give up the progress it has made toward a nuclear weapon. Further attempts to negotiate with North Korea are unlikely. Biden's plan there is to re-engage with South Korea, abandoning Trump's demand for $5 billion to house U.S. troops. But to rein in Pyongyang, he must get the cooperation of its biggest backer, China. How will he do that? Like Trump, Biden wants to prevent China from establishing military hegemony in the strategic South China Sea and halt Chinese stealing of U.S. intellectual property. But Trump's approach, a trade war, hurt the U.S. economy without denting Chinese resolve. Biden is expected to halt the tariff war and instead focus on working with Beijing, along with regional allies Japan, South Korea, and Australia, on areas of common interest. But he also says he will hold Beijing accountable for its atrocious human rights abuses in Xinjiang and its reversal of democratic freedoms in Hong Kong. Balancing these competing interests will be extremely difficult. History cannot be erased, said French diplomat Jean-Marie Guehano, a former UN Undersecretary General. The kind of soft power that the United States has enjoyed in the past has largely evaporated. Forever wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's long past time we end the forever wars, Biden said in his foreign policy address during the campaign. We should bring the vast majority of our troops home from the wars in Afghanistan and the Middle East and narrowly define our mission as defeating al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. But both Iraqis and Afghans are worried about the aftermath of troop withdrawals. After the Obama administration drawdown in Iraq, Iran asserted more influence there, and the Islamic State overran large parts of the country. We do not want Obama's policies to return to our country again, said Iraqi lawmaker Dafer al-Ani. In Afghanistan, a Biden administration is likely to continue Trump's planned withdrawals, but make them contingent on the Taliban keeping their promises to stop attacks on Afghan forces, which so far they have not done. True peace is likely to continue to be elusive. Read a couple of the best columns of the week. We'll start with one from the U.S. A president who isn't a messiah. Our last two presidents both inspired a cult of personality, said Steve Chapman. Barack Obama's oratorical gifts and his breakthrough as the first black president led admirers to believe he could inspire us to new heights and end our racial divisions. Obama described his own election as the moment when the rise of the oceans began to slow and our planet began to heal. 8 years later, Donald Trump was elected after describing the nation as so broken that I alone can fix it. Evangelicals decreed he was chosen by God, and Trump's fervent admirers are still so entranced they've poured into rallies where they stood a good chance of contracting the coronavirus. Previously, John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan were also practically canonized by their supporters. Contrast the excitement and veneration these presidents generated with the modest expectations surrounding the boring, charisma-free Joe Biden. Americans voted for him because he was a serviceable replacement for the incompetent, incorrigible incumbent. He promises only experience, competence, and decency, and his affable personality may cool passions and soothe resentments. The bad news is that Biden will not be a savior. The good news is that he doesn't pretend to be. This is from the UK. U.S. imports will devastate our farmers. American chlorine-washed chicken is one of the big sticking points in a potential U.S.-UK trade deal, said Jay Rayner. But why? It's not as if the rinse makes the food unsafe to eat. The problem is the reason why American agribusiness needs to bleach the meat in the first place, to deal with pathogens as a result of terrible U.S. animal welfare standards. American-style factory farming, which packs chickens and pigs and other animals into tiny, crowded spaces with no room to turn around as they fatten, leaves livestock sick and covered in feces. But it is much cheaper than humane British farming. If we allow a trade agreement to accept such products, British farming will be forced into a cost-cutting war, which will undermine its standards. Such a race to the bottom would drive our own farms out of business, leaving us dependent on the U.S. for food. The U.K. government claims it won't allow chlorinated chicken into the country, but given three chances to enshrine that claim in law, it declined them all. Some argue that we should simply put tariffs on American chicken to level the playing field, but we all know that once those products are allowed in, the haggling will begin, and inevitably, over time, the tariffs will come down. And this is from Tanzania. A brutal blow to African democracy. Is this the end of democracy in Tanzania? Asked Philip Van Niekerk. Tanzania was long a peaceful outlier on a continent plagued by ethnic and political violence. The 2015 election of President John Magufuli marked the beginning of the country's descent into authoritarian rule. For five years of ruthless political repression culminated in last month's election, in which Magufuli claimed to have won an implausible 84.4% of the vote, while the opposition lost nearly all its seats in Parliament, even those in strongholds where it has been entrenched for decades. This isn't just the usual gripe about irregularities. Ballots came pre-marked, boxes pre-stuffed. Police fired tear gas at supporters of Chadema, the opposition party, and its presidential candidate, Tundu Lissu, was banned from the campaign trail for a week for using seditious language and has now fled to Belgium. Chadema founder Freeman Mbowe, meanwhile, has been detained indefinitely on trumped-up charges of terrorism. Why? Evidently, Chadema's campaign, with its grassroots activism and appeal to the poor across the country, represented a very real threat to the power of the ruling party. Lissu and his colleagues have been beaten and bloodied. Africa can only hope that they have not been bowed. It's time for our in-depth article, The Last Word, titled this week, A Calculated Strategy to Undermine the Vote. When election results started to point to a Biden victory, Donald Trump was ready with a plan to sow doubt that was 4 years in the making, said Jim Ruttenberg and Nick Corasaniti in the New York Times. The trouble broke out inside the main counting room in Detroit late on the morning of November 4. It was the day after Election Day, and until the process of tabulating votes from the city's various counting boards had gone smoothly inside the TCF Center, the cavernous convention hall that plays host to the North American International Auto Show. As batches of ballots came in by van, workers methodically inspected them and registered them at 134 separate tables, each monitored by voting rights observers and so-called election challengers from each party. But the posture of the Republican challengers shifted as the count swung in favor of Joe Biden and the word spread that President Donald Trump would sue. One witness, a nonpartisan observer, Julie Maroney, heard a Republican organizer say, "Now we're going to challenge every ballot." Republican volunteers suddenly ramped up their objections across the room, accusations that the workers doing the counting were entering obviously incorrect birth years or backdating ballots. In some cases, the volunteers lodged blanket claims of wrongdoing. "What are you doing?" a worker asked a Republican observer who was challenging ballots before he was able to even begin to inspect them. A Democratic observer, Seth Furlow, recalled. The Republican observer responded, "I was told to challenge everyone." Furlow vividly recalled his discomfort with a scene in which mostly white Republican challengers were confronting the mostly black election workers. Already the police had escorted a handful of particularly disruptive observers from the room, but tensions increased when election officials noticed that the number of challengers had grown well beyond what each side was permitted and barred entry into a bid to reduce their ranks. Shouts of "stop the count" went up among Republicans. The fraud that Republicans claimed to observe was not fraud at all, a Michigan state judge determined last week in rejecting a lawsuit filed by allies of Trump. The various instances of supposed malfeasance were in fact well-established procedures for dealing with the peculiarities of data entry, the correction of minor errors, and protocols for social distancing, all intended to ensure a careful and accurate vote count. But in the fact-twisting narrative of Trump, his political allies, and his supporters, the Detroit Counting Center was a crime scene where Democrats stole an election, a miscarriage demanding that outrage be channeled through the courts, presidential Twitter posts, and cable news stemwinders. And that was the plan envisioned by the pro-Trump forces all along. Like similar episodes in Las Vegas, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh, the scene in Detroit was the culmination of a years-long strategy by Trump to use the power of the executive branch, an army of lawyers, the echo chamber of conservative news media, and the obedience of fellow Republicans to try out his most audacious exercise in bending reality, to turn losing into winning. The roots of Trump's approach date to before the election of 2016, and he advanced his plans throughout his term. But his strategy for casting doubt on the outcome of the 2020 campaign took shape in earnest when the coronavirus pandemic upended normal life and led states to promote voting by mail. From the start, the president saw mail-in ballots as a political threat that would appeal more to Democrats than his followers. And so he and his allies sought to block moves to make absentee voting easier and to slow the counting of mail ballots. This allowed Trump to do two things: claim an early victory on election night and paint ballots that were counted later for his opponent as fraudulent. The U.S. Postal Service, after coming under the leadership of a Trump ally, Louis DeJoy, made several cost-saving moves that severely slowed mail delivery rates and prompted broad concern about mail ballots arriving on time. In the Senate, Republicans led by Senator Mitch McConnell blocked Democratic efforts to get more money to states so they could buy more sorting equipment to count the huge influx of mail ballots faster. In key states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, Republican-controlled legislatures refused attempts by civil rights groups and Democrats to change or suspend statutes forbidding election workers from beginning to count ballots before Election Day. And once the counting began, the Trump campaign and the president's allies pursued other tactics to slow or stop the count and seed doubt about the validity of the results. Before Election Day, party officials at the state and national levels helped organize teams of observers, a role that was once a symbol of the transparency of American democracy. But in this case, Trump and his allies encouraged their observers in key states to act aggressively to stop what they had portrayed as widespread cheating and provide information that could be fed into lawsuits and stoke demonstrations and coverage from friendly commentators and journalists. Nearly all of it would be done in the name of a falsehood, that the American voting system was so corroded by fraud that any losing result for the president could not be legitimate. At the end of the 2016 campaign, facing what he and the entire political world expected to be a loss, Trump regularly repeated the claim that the election was rigged in favor of his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton. International and domestic allies, the ambush video activist James O'Keefe, Russian troll networks, Sean Hannity, and InfoWars backed him up. Roger Stone, a longtime advisor to Trump and a perennial Republican trickster, created an outside group, Stop the Steal, that sought to enlist poll observers to collect evidence of Democratic cheating. Trump's advisors readied legal go teams to jet anywhere he could press a claim. Trump's Electoral College victory rendered those 2016 plans unnecessary, but the incoming president had reason to cling to the falsehood as a way to cast doubt on the reality that he had lost the popular vote by a margin of nearly 3 million. Trump even went so far as to impanel a presidential commission to endorse his charge about widespread voter fraud, led by Vice President Mike Pence and Chris Kobach, a former Kansas Secretary of State and prominent supporter of the baseless idea that voter fraud is a national threat. The commission disbanded amid lawsuits and dissension without issuing findings, but internal documents later released through litigation showed that even before its work truly began, it had the outline for a report to claim systematic voter fraud. In November 2019, Justin Clark, a senior Trump advisor, visited with Republicans in Madison, Wisconsin, to emphasize just how important the state was to Trump's prospects. He signaled how voter fraud allegations would be key to any Trump strategy in 2020, according to a recording that leaked to the Associated Press in December. Clark explained how a ruling from a voter intimidation case against Republicans in New Jersey in the early 1980s had led to a long-standing judicial decree forbidding the Republican National Committee from sending and organizing poll watchers in elections. But that decree lapsed in 2018, which, Clark said, gave the National Party a new ability to send challengers into polls in 2020 and coordinate in every battleground state. The challengers would be focused on Democratic, quote, cheating, he said, and the Republican Party would have an ability it never had before to blast those charges far and wide through the social media accounts of the President of the United States. Wisconsin was one of three key battleground states, along with Pennsylvania and Michigan, where the president had loyal allies who controlled the state legislatures, but where Democrats were in the governor's mansions. During the pandemic, that political dynamic generated clashes that grew more intense as the key role of mail-in balloting became apparent, with Democrats voting by mail in large numbers during primary elections in the spring. The need for more money and new procedures to help process mail ballots more quickly became evident. In Pennsylvania, local election administrators and Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, sought to allow processing of mail ballots, known as pre-canvassing, as early as 3 weeks before Election Day. Republicans publicly signaled a willingness to work on the issue, but kept attaching conditions. One demand sought to do away with drop boxes, which voters could use for ballots as opposed to the regular mail system. Another wanted new signature matching requirements or to eradicate a provision requiring all poll watchers to live in the county. Every time we agreed to something that was put out there, they'd raise the bar, said Jay Costa, the Democratic minority leader in the state Senate, who was leading the negotiations. Eventually, there seemed to be some momentum behind an agreement that would have allowed for 3 days of pre-canvassing, enhanced security measures for drop boxes, and ballots postmarked on Election Day and received within 3 days to be counted. But the deal abruptly fell apart after a Republican caucus meeting in the lower chamber. By this fall, Trump looked increasingly likely to have an early advantage on Election Day as the in-person vote came in, but to badly lose the mail-in vote and potentially the presidency along with it. A digital consulting firm founded by Michael Bloomberg, Hawkfish, called the early returns the Red Mirage. The president and his allies began a concerted campaign to twist that situation, one to which they contributed by opposing early counting of mail ballots, into something more sinister. Trump urged followers to become poll watchers. When you go there, watch all the thieving and stealing and robbing they do, he said at a rally in North Carolina. On Election Day, Trump delivered much the same message to staff members, supporters, and followers at the White House as the votes were being tabulated around the country and his early leads were slipping away. We were winning everything, and all of a sudden it was just called off, he said. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 o'clock in the morning and add them to the list. As Democrats, opposing lawyers, fact-checkers, and in some cases judges pressed for evidence, the Trump campaign released what Kayleigh McEnany, the White House press secretary, called 234 pages of sworn affidavits from the Trump poll watchers in Detroit. Real people, real allegations, signed with notaries. The affidavits were connected to a last-ditch federal lawsuit by the Trump campaign to prohibit Detroit from certifying its results. But much of what they described were merely standard procedures intended to ensure an accurate and legal count. For instance, Republicans who believed that they had witnessed fraud when workers input birth dates from 1900 for some mail ballots apparently did not understand that this was done in cases where information other than dates of birth was being used for verification, and that the dates were not readily available. The 1900 date was a placeholder for the computer program, which required something in the birth date field. Last week, Judge Timothy M. Kinney dismissed the suit in a Michigan court, largely on the basis that the affidavits were meaningless. The suit's interpretation of events is incorrect and not credible, he found. But when thousands of the president's supporters demonstrated in Washington at the end of the week, the legal losses and electoral implausibilities were irrelevant. As they marched through the streets holding an enormous Trump flag flecked with white stars against a Navy backdrop, they repeatedly chanted the phrase planted 4 years ago by Stone: "Stop the steal." A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. We'll finish out the hour on the talking points page. We'll start with yet another story about Trump. It says, what's next for him and Trumpism? With President Trump's remaining days in the White House ticking down, one question looms large, said David Jackson and John Fritz in USA Today. What's Trump's next act? He reportedly is talking about launching a conservative television network or streaming media company to take on Fox News, whose coverage of the election angered him. He may recast himself as a television personality or radio host. Whatever he chooses to do, he's not about to fade into the background. With a rabid following and an unquenchable thirst for attention, he'll continue to be a presence on the national stage and to leverage his influence over a Republican Party he has transformed. Trump will no doubt continue wielding his Twitter megaphone, said W. James Antle III in WashingtonExaminer.com, but he won't likely stop there. He could launch a super PAC to promote like-minded Republicans who kiss his ring, and he has strongly hinted he may run again himself in 2024 when he'll be 78. Once Trump finally leaves the White House, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times, he may be shocked at how diminished he quickly becomes. Ripped from the sanctuary of the Oval Office, the president is likely to be consumed by lawsuits and criminal investigations. He faces numerous civil actions, including two defamation suits by women who've accused him of sexual assault. He's also being investigated by Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr., who could be looking at tax fraud, insurance fraud, and falsification of business records. And New York State Attorney General Letitia James is probing possible financial chicanery by the Trump Organization. Federal prosecution for a host of potential crimes is also possible, unless he resigns in return for a pardon. And he faces a mountain of debt, including $421 million in personally guaranteed loans that mostly come due within a few years. Meanwhile, Trump's business empire faces its deepest challenges in decades, said Brian Spiegel and Caitlin Ostroff in the Wall Street Journal. The pandemic has hammered his hotels and resorts. The financial benefits bestowed on his businesses by the presidency are likely to vanish, and the organization faces a massive cash crunch with wary lenders unlikely to bail him out. If Trump does decide to run in 2024, he's a shoo-in for the nomination, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. With the most loyal base in modern history, he just commandeered an army of 73 million voters to beat back a threatened blue wave. No sane Republican would challenge him. Even if he doesn't run, Trump could establish himself as a kingmaker of sorts, said Peter Nicholas in the Atlantic.com. He's formed an emotional bond with his base that isn't about to vanish and will still be seen as the party's de facto leader by candidates who will trek to Mar-a-Lago for endorsements and position themselves as heirs to the movement he rode to power. Don't be so certain of that, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. Once deprived of the White House bully pulpit, Trump can no longer count on making a splash every time he blasts out an angry tweet or insults a rival. And as the former reality TV star knows better than anyone, audiences are fickle and crave novelty. As the media's focus shifts to Biden presidency and the raft of troubles facing the nation, with each passing day, he will become less and less relevant. For a cautionary tale, consider Sarah Palin, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg.com. After losing her vice presidential bid alongside John McCain in 2008, she tried to leverage her passionate populist support into a media career. 3 years later, she was a washed-up reality TV star. Even if Trump doesn't endure, Trumpism will live on, said Kevin Williamson in the Washington Post. He's galvanized voters with a politics of blame that's less a governing philosophy than it is an enemies list made up of political, corporate, and media elites. Now that he's whetted many Americans' appetite for an angry politics of cathartic confrontation, that genie is not going back into the bottle easily. Democrats should be alarmed at the prospect of a Trumpian populist movement led not by a fading cartoon, but by a smart, disciplined, professional politician like Senators Ted Cruz, Tom Cotton, and Rick Scott, and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. Sorry, but no professional politician will succeed at Trumpism, said Virginia Postrel in Bloomberg.com. A natural showman, Trump offers his disciples emotional release by shamelessly thumbing his nose at propriety and scorning bourgeois virtues. He's pure id. That's his core appeal. Trumpism without Trump is like chocolate chip ice cream without its defining ingredient. In other words, plain vanilla. Alito taking aim at progressives. Samuel Alito sounded more like a Republican candidate on the stump last week than he did a sitting Supreme Court justice, said Scott Lemieux in NBCNews.com. Addressing the conservative Federalist Society, Alito, who, with Clarence Thomas, anchors the court's far-right flank, spoke with a piercing sense of persecution and resentment, despite the society's successful campaign to stock federal courts with fellow conservatives. He complained that COVID-19 has led to previously unimaginable restrictions on individual liberty, particularly limits on church services. He bemoaned the court's ruling on same-sex marriage, saying traditional beliefs about marriage are now considered bigotry. Alito, 70, also attacked five Democratic senators for saying the court is too influenced by politics, calling their amicus brief an affront to the Constitution. With this brazen speech, Alito telegraphed his intentions for the court's new 6-3 conservative majority to go to war. Alito didn't say anything he hasn't written in judicial opinion, said Ed Whelan in NationalReview.com. While it's improper for a justice to speak publicly about an open issue on which the justice hasn't yet ruled, as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg did regarding same-sex marriage and President Trump's tax returns, justices routinely write books and give speeches expanding on positions they've already formally adopted. In Alito's concurring opinion in the landmark 2018 Masterpiece Cake Shop case, for example, he defended a Colorado bakery for declining to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, writing, "It is in protecting unpopular religious beliefs that we prove this country's commitment to serving as a refuge for religious freedom." Alito's speech was a brave defense of constitutional rights, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Liberals want to compel conformity to their views, but courts provide a check on tyranny of the majority. Alito's cranky views are well known, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. But it was still surprising to hear a Supreme Court justice sound like a talk radio host. Alito's bitterness is even more remarkable because his side is winning. Alito knows that, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. So his speech sounded like a taunt to the left. There is now nothing liberals can do to curb the power of the conservative judges in federal courts. For Alito and the Federalist Society, the future looks as bright as ever. And just time for a couple of short notes. About a third of Americans know someone who's died of COVID-19, researchers estimate. Nearly all have someone in their social circle who's been infected. The coronavirus has sidelined more than 130 Secret Service officers assigned to protect President Trump because they were either infected or quarantined after having close contact with infected colleagues. Since March, some 300 Secret Service agents have been infected or quarantined, at least partly because of their presence at Trump's campaign rallies. And we'll end with a quote from writer Robert Musil, quoted in thebrowser.com, who says, "Progress would be wonderful if only it would stop." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.